Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. And this week, we have a kind of a special episode, a follow-up to one of our more interesting episodes. Some of you might remember with Cameron Cloutier, our Eurons episode. But first, I am joined by Stuart Balk. Stay hello, Stu.
Hi.
And we are also joined by Mr. Don Grace.
Hello.
Hello, and we are joined by some special guests. We are joined by Michelle Cruz.
Hello.
And we are also joined by John Quasar. Say hello, John.
How are you, everybody?
Good. Good.
Very good.
So I'm going to hand the show over to John because he is more of an expert on the Eurons subject. So, John.
I don't like to use the word expert, but I do know a bit about it. And I was approached by these guys about doing the show, and we feel strongly about the case. The Eerie Rapist, original Night Stalker, was a briefly known as Eurons, was a abbreviated, it's Eurons, and that's how you'll usually find it on the web. And also, there was an attempt to call him the Golden State Killer. I don't think that name is really sticking. We'll get to that later. He was a serial killer, rapist, terrorized California in the 1970s and 1980s. At first, law enforcement thought it was two separate offenders until DNA linked about 16 years ago. They figured out it was the same guy. I believe by some accounts, he is the most prolific unidentified offender in California history. And it's a fascinatingly strange case. It's pretty horrifying. It's gruesome. If you heard an earlier show from a few years back, it this is a serious subject, so we're not going to be joking around too much tonight. Yeah. But anyway, John Quasar is a published writer, online investigator. How else would you describe yourself, John?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't try. I've been called a real life Kolchak. That's the only thing that has really stuck, since I don't have really one genre that I follow.
Right, because you cover
an interesting mystery.
Right, true crime.
I will investigate it.
Yeah, and you've done writings on Zodiac.
X-Files type of stuff.
Right. The Lindbergh baby, you've been writing about that.
The unexplained mysteries, serial killers, frankly, are the most interesting and most rewarding because you can then bring someone to justice.
Right.
So that's more or less what I've been known for now for the past few years. People don't want me to talk about some of the weird stuff I investigate. They just want me to talk about the true crime subjects, and in particular this one now, because I've never been fashionable. I've never been ahead of the game. But accidentally, it happened. Basically, it's in my backyard. My sister and I inherited our mother's house when she passed away. And she lives south of Sacramento. And I had just finished doing all this crime scene investigation for my work on Zodiac, and I really began to enjoy visiting the locations and photography. I've never been a very good photographer. And so I thought, why don't I do that with this case? I read Lieutenant Crompton's book, Sudden Terror, which was the only book at the time about 5 years ago. And self-published, but I don't think it's bad at all. And he was one of the detectives on the case, and he was horrified to see the reports being destroyed. Because at that time, those reports applied only to the rapes, and they were limited in statute of limitations. And he made friends with, he was a Concord detective. EAR struck over in Northern California, and he became friends with the head of the original investigation in Sacramento, Jim Bevins. And Bevins gave him all the reports. So Crompton did a tremendous thing for history in that he actually reached in and saved all these reports from being destroyed, the officer-generated logs and everything. And some 30 years later, he wrote his self-published book, Sudden Terror, and though he dramatized it, he did maintain the original verbatim dialogue that EAR spoke and that the victim spoke back to him during the attacks, and the street names of the attacks and so forth. And that's really all I had until I went and got newspaper accounts, and I started getting a nose for how this guy stalked. I started going to all the neighborhoods. I started finding how he did this. I could then walk in the path of the bloodhounds who had traced EAR's scent to his car where they would vector. And it became easier as I went along because a lot of street names were not known. You cannot live around the Sacramento area and not know someone who does not know a victim.
Really?
And that happened,
wow.
with me. So I was introduced to more than one victim, a mutual friend. Everybody remembers it here. He sent this, not since London was sent into a panic by Jack the Ripper in 1888. Has the city gone into panic over a serial offender? But EAR did that here because he was not really a rapist. The victims wanted that understood, and the mayor of Davis, college town up here where he also struck, made it clear at the time in the newspaper, he said he's a sexual terrorist. He's not a rapist. And that is basically what sent the city into a panic beginning in 1976 when he struck in the summer. This is now the 40th year. Well, he would scout out, prowl an average neighborhood, middle-class neighborhood, almost tactically assess a home, and he began to get better. He began to incorporate canals in his stalking pattern. The home would be behind a school playground, behind a park, on the other side of a park. By one of the power pylon corridors that you would see, by the levee we have up here by the American River, on a canal, as I said, and a couple of other tactical allies he would use, so he would never be seen prowling. He made himself very ghostly. There are a number of sketches purporting to be him, but no one is really sure if it is, because it was seen as someone, you know, that was suspicious in the neighborhood. It was a young man. The sketches can sometimes be radically different. That's how careful he was. This became an enormous hobby for him. The amount of time he must have spent stalking the neighborhood, getting in the home before the fact, often checking it out, sometimes leaving his ligatures under a cushion, or he would get in the home the night of the attack long enough in advance to remove the shoelaces from the victim's shoes and use those to tie them up. And he would leave a curious, the police finally found these curious marks on the screens of victims' homes and sometimes on the neighbors. It was in the lower left corner, and that would, of course, be where the window would be open. And I assessed that he was trying to figure out the acoustics in the house. He would scratch on this to see how heavy or light sleepers people were, if a dog would come. He covered his bases. He would use hang-up phone calls. One of the detectives in Shelby still does not know how he got everybody's phone number in advance, including neighbors. I have said it's probably city directories, but still that doesn't answer at all. But he would make hang-up phone calls, and the assumption is, I think everybody mostly agrees, that he's trying to assess their movements, the time of day they're around and not around, including the neighbors, so he could stalk and strike at certain times when, you know, the neighborhood at its quietest. And this is how premeditated he was. And he would strike in the home. This was not an impulsive rapist who's out there waving a jogger on the path or something. He carefully assessed the home and in some cases apparently ingratiated himself to a dog if the dog was in the house, because the dogs would be barking to the detectives when they were talking to the victims later. But the dog would do nothing to him. And he apparently also had an unusual biochemistry because the bloodhounds, according to more than one detective, would go to pieces when they'd get a scent. They'd slobber and shake. And that told the handlers either he has some kind of disease that has changed his biochemistry or he's a heavy-duty drug offender.
Mm.
So we're beginning to put together this unbelievable type of villain who sends dogs, you know, wild. He is a careful perpetrator. He gets in the home after all these this careful stalking, and he basically materializes over the bed of his victim with a flashlight in their face and a gun in one hand, and he's snarling through clenched teeth, always disguising his voice. And he's always trying to sound angry and threatening and clenching and distorting his voice, hissing in their ear, and stalking, padding about the house quietly, ransacking them, taking the victim to the living room or family room if he got them in bed. And when he finally struck husbands, I mean, when he finally struck a husband and wife together, he'd leave the husband in the bedroom and put plates on his back. So if he heard them, after he tied him up, if he heard them, he would then rush back there. He threatened to kill them. And the victim would then be laying on the floor, invariably, in the family room, and he would pad about the house, eating their food. He would ransack their drawers. He would reveal things that he had stalked them before, because he would know where some things were. He would unplug the heater for some reason. He would turn on the TV. He would put towels in front of it to dim the light, or he'd put towels over a lamp to dim the light, and he would do his thing and come back for more and ransack the house. And he'd come up to them very quietly when the victims would think he was gone. Then he'd snip a large pair of scissors by their ear and then hiss in their ear and snarl.
Jesus.
And so this, nothing could stop him. And finally, when Sacramento announced after its eighth victim that they had a serial rapist on the loose, well, it began to build after that. And that was in the fall of 1976. And in 1977, he finally sent Sacramento in panic because he was unstoppable. And the newspapers kept reporting this. The 13th victim, 14th, 15th, each few weeks, there would be another number. And the Sacramento Bee and the Sacramento Union would have maps charting where he's hitting in the East area. That's where he got his name. They called him the East Area Rapist because of that. And there began rather the misnomer about this guy was just a rapist, and he was not, you know, really what he was, the true terrorist. And that was how he, then in May 1977 is when he really did it. He sent Sacramento over the edge by striking five times. And there was a vigilante group out there with CB radios riding around, two men per car. The sheriffs would not allow more than one car at a time in a location because they're afraid these guys would gang together and accidentally hang someone who's simply walking around a neighborhood. You had dentist Gil Martin offered $15,000, and the B matched it with another $15,000 reward. And it just kept going on. He came back after the summer of 77. He struck in Stockton. He came back to the East area. His MO seldom changed. He would say the same things. He would strike terror. He would make the hang of phone calls. Dogs wouldn't stop him. Nothing. He started striking in Modesto. Davis, Stockton again, back and forth from Modesto and Davis, back in Sacramento again. And it was finally 30-some-odd victims, and he, and possibly a double murder in Rancho Cordova again where he began. It's debated whether he killed the Majoras who were out walking their dog one night, and they came across someone who chased them and then shot them down in the dark in a basic residential street. And there are composites of the supposed perpetrator, one that does match other EAR composites to an extent. And ligatures were found on the lawn, which is his trademark. These were a little different than how he used them, but on the whole, they thought that he had been spotted doing something. And for some reason, he had to chase down this Sergeant Brian Majora and his newlywed wife, Katie Majora, and kill them both. But I'm skeptical as if he really is the killer. In any case, he by this time had more than 30 victims. He moved on. And victim 38 was then in Concord, which is in the East Bay Area of California. And then 39 and 40, he would go up and down Highway 680 in this narrow corridor, and he would strike off the highway in neighborhoods that, again, fit his pattern. There's a park, there's a levee, there's a jogging path nearby. It did not vary. He was that careful in his stalking modus operandi. And after a rather interesting attack in the summer, July 5 of 1979 in Danville, in which the couple woke up, and the man got a look at this guy standing at the by the high boy, putting the mask on over his face. The guy started shouting at him, "So what are you doing in here?" and so forth. And he shouted and caused a roar, and he had his wife run past him and go downstairs. He kept shouting at the guy. The guy didn't move at all. He just froze, staring at him through the mask. And this man then ran downstairs, and they got out, and it was thought that that was the East Area Rapist, because he struck in that area before. And in his wake, he must have rushed out of there. The bloodhounds found where he had parked, and they found a map of a community that has not truly been identified. They found paperwork of writing that was kind of strange, like an old class report. It mentions General Custer and all this stuff. And it looks like a younger man's writing. And then he never struck again in Northern California. And suddenly, in October of 1979, the exact same M.O. pops up in a villain in Goleta, California. Same thing, clenched teeth, hissing, snarling, sounding angry, scaring this couple in their home. The home is by a canal, a park, a creek. It fits his pattern. He had a knife, a gun, the flashlight, the whole bit, and he kept saying, "I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill him." He would do that. He'd talk to himself. He'd act like he's talking to someone else sometimes, and he lost control. They got away, and he got out of there on his bike. An FBI agent lived right next door and chased him on a bike, and he got away. But the MO was so similar that there was suspicion in these Northern California detectives that this was the same guy that they were after. But it was never certain. And then there is no more after victim 40. These were 49, number 49. There was never any of his strikes again. However, in December, a couple was murdered. They were nearby to this, where this last home was. They were in a condominium complex. Obviously, Dr. Offerman was the victim. He must have challenged his assailant. Bindings were only on one wrist, so he had gotten loose. The assailant shot him several times in the back and chest, I believe, and then went around the bed and shot his companion, Dr. Manning, once in the head, execution style, and got out of there. And after that, that MO was not seen again, but up and down the Highway 101 and Highway 5 in Southern California from Goleta, which is just north of Santa Barbara, to Dana Point, which is down there by San Luis Obispo, the same pattern was turning up maybe 2.5 months, 3 months sometimes, maybe 6 months. A couple in a community that matched EAR's MO. There was a canal, one house, you know, one lot over. A park might be behind the house. The exact same tactical allies he used were obvious. But this assailant was now, frankly, bludgeoning his couple to death. He would apparently do exactly what EAR did, bind them in the master bedroom, take the woman away, and I guess do everything he did up in Sacramento, and then end up bludgeoning them to death.
I just want to ask a question there quickly, John. I've heard conflicting reports before that around this time of the late 70s, they said that the attacker was anywhere aged between 18 and 30. It's a big discrepancy in age. Can you answer?
It depends how what kind of view they got of him. The earliest victims had encounters with him when he really was not, you know, fully developed in his how careful he was. And they described him as having a very young voice, the way he spoke.
Right.
So it would all depend really on the capability of the victim. I do go with the younger victim, with the younger perpetrator, because at number one on Paseo Drive in Rancho Cordova, he actually tried to cut the phone line outside the house, which is very very amateurish.
Yeah.
And after that, when you'd get in the house, he would just rip the phone out of the jack or cut the line, which is far better. He failed in doing that with victim one. The line wouldn't cut, and he stood on a birdbath, and that gave way under him.
Okay.
But he refined himself, and I would say he's under 60 now if he's still with us. He could be very much alive and attainable. But he was so careful that the police and all these jurisdictions could not even link him definitely with these murder victims down there, because he was also imitating the bedroom basher who was afoot at that time.
And the terrible thing as well is that California, and obviously I don't live in America, so the layout of California to me is very, very foreign. They would have just been coming out of the grip of terror, or probably still in the grip of terror of Zodiac. And they got this idiot running around as well.
I wouldn't say Zodiac anymore in the late 70s and early 80s. He was just a San Francisco. He was really quite in the Bay Area. Concord is a mountain range over. It's East Bay. So I wouldn't say Zodiac was as frightening as this guy to people, because this guy got in your house. This guy stalked you, and he got in several homes, and he terrorized you for hours in your house. And then he ended up starting to kill his victims by bludgeoning them with a bludgeon he found at the home. So he was there already. He made sure everything was there. So he brought no evidence with him that could be left and traced to him. He took nothing with him that they could use to find him.
But he was eating turkey dinners.
Well, I've heard that. It was one at the Offerman's. I'm not really sure about all that. He would eat at everybody's home. I've also heard about a dog being brought, and then there's some kind of contradiction there.
Right.
Yeah.
But that is his pattern. He would lord over the house. He would be drinking beers. He would go out on the patio and crash for a while. He would smoke cigarettes.
Jeez.
And he'd eat their food, or he'd take their drugs if they had them.
Sounds like reckless behavior for a guy who's so careful. I mean,
yeah, really.
Not that killing people isn't reckless behavior, but, you know.
But as careful as he was, I don't think he took risks that often. He was opportunistic a few times. But I likened him to the real-life Michael Myers. That's what finally started getting him attention, when I put everything online, because I was not going to write a book. That could not be done. A couple of detectives already did it, and I encouraged people to get their books. But I wanted to get the guy. I wanted to stalk the ultimate stalker and figure out how he was doing this, how he could possibly do all of this, and then pick up the trail again. Instead of processing as cold case is usually done, I wanted to investigate as though this was hot, just going on and visit each place. And the only thing that could really bring him to people's minds to they could lock onto something was to really liken him like Michael Myers, because he liked masks. He appeared out of nowhere. I mean, he left footprints, so you know he's walking around, but like Michael Myers in Halloween, he was just there. He would pop up and go.
And I was watching
that began to crystallize with people. Because otherwise, he had such a lousy handle.
I was watching the cold case today, and I was thinking about Michael Myers while I was watching it, because it sounds like when I hear the stories, I kind of see that type of 70s. I see it through that 70s movie filter in my head almost.
That's pretty accurate.
That's informed by John Carpenter movies, you know?
Yeah. I think of Bob Clark's Black Christmas. That's what he reminds me of.
That's a good pull, John. Absolutely.
Well, the good thing about some of those 70s movies, they were so low budget that you're really seeing the 70s unvarnished. As with Halloween, they were wearing their own clothes.
Yeah.
That's what Jamie Lee Curtis said. She went and bought her own clothes for the part.
And now cutting around their own bag of leaves to emulate the fall.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Yeah. Some painted leaves.
And that's what whole communities were going through with this guy. Basically, he was striking Haddonfield. He was striking the middle-class neighborhoods and the small eastern suburbs. And that's sent the shutters through everybody.
Right. Now, John, once he's in Southern California, he's killing couples. Then his last two victims, if I'm recalling correctly, are two women alone. In their houses.
Manuela was his first Irvine victim in 1981,
right.
I believe. And then he went back up to Goleta and killed the Dominguez couple, Sherry Dominguez and Greg Sanchez, her friend, not far again from the Offermans and from his first strike there, still following his same pattern. And then he disappeared for 5 years, and no one knows where he went, but he came back on May 4, 1986, and struck only a mile from where he had killed Manuela. Mm-hmm. And that would be his last victim. He reverted to his original MO. He struck a teenage girl alone, which is how he began. And Michelle is with us here tonight. This is Janelle Cruz was his final victim, and Michelle is her sister. She's with us tonight, I know. So she can talk about that and what she's gone through.
Michelle, you want to you want to introduce yourself as this summation continues?
My sister is Janelle Cruz. She was the last known victim in 1986. She was killed May 4th. At the end of the night, probably around maybe 11 o'clock, just before midnight, possibly before midnight. So there's kind of a question between May 4th, May 5th. She was home alone. Actually, what happened was is she had a friend over there until about 10:45 at night, and then he had to go home. I think he was only 17, 18 years old, and Janelle was 18 at the time. He had to go home, and then she actually left at the same time and went somewhere. I think she probably went up to the store and came back maybe 15 minutes later. And from what I was told, what I remember is a friend had called her somewhere between 11 and 12, and the phone didn't answer. So I'm assuming she was probably being attacked at that time. And the next day, a realtor was showing the home. I believe it was a realtor showing the home is what I can remember. Maybe Gian remembers that. But yeah, a realtor found her. Well, I know it was a realtor who found her, but I don't know if the realtor was just previewing the home or if they actually had a client with them. They found her, and that's when they had, called the broker, and then they ended up calling, the police, and that's when they had the house taped up and started questioning everybody.
So Janelle lived alone, on her own at
18? Well, at the time, no. Actually, when Janelle was there alone, my parents had just left on vacation to Mexico.
Ah, okay.
I believe they left on Friday or Saturday, so she was only home alone for a day or two. And I know that night that she had made some phone calls trying to get someone to stay with her because she didn't want to stay by herself. But unfortunately, nobody could. And so she had a friend from work come hang out with her for a little bit. And he was only a friend. A lot of people wonder about that. But he was just a friend.
All right.
And then, like I said, he had to go home. I was not there because I was actually in the mountains skiing. I was working up in the mountain at the time. So I was gone for about 2 months. I didn't come back until about a week after or a few days after I heard that she was killed. I was in a snowstorm, so I couldn't get out.
Yeah.
But got home as soon as I could.
What was Janelle's job at the time?
Janelle was 18, and she had just gotten a job at a pizza place called Bullwinkle's, which is like a Chuck E. Cheese-type restaurant, family-oriented. And she had only been there for about 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, prior to that, she was working at a deli, and the deli was in Northwood, and it was a little, just a really small little deli that was in our little community.
Michelle, I want to ask, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. I went back and listened to our original Eons episode we did about 2.5 years ago with Cameron Cloutier. And he said that Janelle had a dark side to her. If you don't want to elaborate or don't want to answer that, you don't have to. I'm just was curious at the time last night when I was listening to it what that was.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what he was talking about, but, Janelle, unfortunately, had been raped about maybe 2 years before she was killed.
Oh, good Lord.
So maybe that could have been the dark past that he was talking about. Okay. And so she rebelled a little bit after that. And she, you know, she was withdrawn, but kind of was rebelling a little bit. But she got out of that in the end. She went into the Job Corps and did really well. And she was doing actually really good at the time. She was looking for apartments to live and trying to get herself set up in college. So at the end, she was doing really well for herself.
Okay.
Now, Michelle, is it true, because I've read this, that there was a party at the house a few nights before and a masked man had jumped the fence and was confronted by the partygoers?
No, a few nights before, no. I mean, it wasn't a party. She had a couple of friends over, but okay. That was not unusual. We always had friends come over and hang out with us. We were young, so my parents were gone. She probably had a few friends over. I know she had at least two or three friends over, and they did hear some noises and went out to check, but they did not see anything. They came back, and okay. Janelle was on the phone at the time. But the guys went and checked and didn't see anything.
So that's one legend completely debunked right now. So
yeah, it's not a party, no.
Did the police, I'm sure the police investigated thoroughly, did they consider the angle that it was a customer at one of the restaurants she had worked in, possibly had seen her there and been stalking her from there?
Well, I'm sure they probably did consider that, because they did question a lot of coworkers and management at her job, and they definitely did talk to a lot of people over there. So I'm sure they did think something, had to do with her job.
Okay, perhaps John can add to this, because there is talk that a majority of the houses struck were being put up for sale or were being prepped.
Many of them, yes. Many of them had a sale sign eventually or had just been sold. And so that was one of the theories, that he was in real estate or had some access, and that did become part of his MO. There's no question about that, but it didn't lead anywhere. That's the thing. When you look at the whole neighborhood, you see how he was very careful in winnowing down a certain home, usually the corner house or second from the corner. And it would be a remarkable coincidence if he was doing that through real estate. I think he just selected neighborhoods, started refining it, and the real estate helped him narrow down if there was a viable victim. That is very commonplace.
Right.
I'm sure that a lot of people have pondered over why the 5-year absence. I mean, incarceration obviously is the first one that comes to mind. He's most likely incarcerated, but if he wasn't, what was the such a long?
I would think military.
Military service? Okay.
Mm-hmm. 4 years maybe, or he moved away somewhere else and there were attacks and we simply don't know of them because it's so far removed. He was very careful. That's why in Michelle's case, and Michelle told me how, and Debbie Domingo also said this, Sherry Domingo's daughter, how this was thought to be maybe a personal attack on their family by someone they knew, and they were looking over their shoulders for 16 or so years, not knowing that this was actually the act of a serial killer. That's how unconnected these cases were at the time. And then Michelle can tell you when they found out that it was actually when the DNA linked in, 2001?
Mm-hmm.
And they finally realized.
Yeah, I had no idea. I was just thinking it was possibly a friend of a friend. I didn't think it was any of my immediate friends. We were all, 15, 16, 17, 18, so I didn't think it was our friends. But it definitely could have been someone they were hanging out with or work with, or, maybe somebody that my mom knew, or, just didn't know. Had no idea. So we were always skeptical about everybody, really.
Right.
It's something you usually don't hear about, how someone has to look over their shoulder for so many years, not knowing really what the motive was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, locked windows, propping things up against my doors and windows, for years afterwards. Terrible.
Now, he was known to make phone calls to victims after he struck. Like, what was the longest one? Maybe. Because I've never gotten a definitive date on some of those calls, but supposedly there was one as late as 1992.
I don't know about that, but he
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, I got some cables.
You did?
Well, yeah, after the press conference where they linked DNA, right after that, I started getting a lot of calls where I'd come home from work and answer the phone, and it would just be kind of a soft breathing maybe, or maybe nothing at all, but they didn't hang up. They just listened to me, and then I'd hang up, and they'd call me back again, probably, you know, a couple times a night. Mm-hmm. And that probably went on for about a week right after the conference, you know, the press conference in 2001.
So this is as far as early as 2001, you were getting these. Okay.
I was, yeah. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, he saw me on, you know, the press conference that, you know, that I attended. So again, it's like we're constantly wondering who's watching us, you know.
Yeah, there's rumors out there that he was making calls as late as the early 2000s, and maybe that's what started the rumors.
He began, what, late 77, early 1978. The one that's out there, the recorded call that you can access, you can play it on your show, I assume.
Yeah, I think we played it on the Cameron episode.
Yeah, we kicked off the show with that. Yeah.
It's that's from January 2, 1978. And so you can imagine what kind of black book this guy must have had, that he kept all the numbers and were able to collate them with his victims, because he must have had all the numbers of the neighbors as well. So he must have gone through, you know, striking out who he didn't strike or whatever. And years later, he still had that that thick book of all his of all these neighborhoods, because he, you know, he didn't strike in some neighborhoods, though he prowled there. And so he must have had an enormous black book of all these phone numbers, and then collated somehow with the address or the victim's name. He didn't always have their names, so I don't know how he did it, but he just really had some kind of... Did he? I meant to ask Michelle, because I only thought of it a couple of days ago. Were there hang-up phone calls coming to... Oh, well, you wouldn't know, I guess, huh?
I wasn't there, yeah, and my mom doesn't recall that. I've asked her, but she doesn't recall. And, yeah, I wasn't there, so I'm not really sure.
See, I noticed that in all the victims of his, of when he was known as Original Night Stalker, nobody within the immediate family who had survived or friends ever said that the couple had complained of hang-up phone calls before. So I don't know if he did not use that that tactic at all with any of his murder victims.
Yeah, I don't know.
Meticulous.
He was, yeah.
If anything, yeah.
Yeah, I should note there's at least two other calls that I think have pretty much confirmed to be him, where he's basically taunting the police in one phone call, and it was made to the police department in Sacramento. And then there's another one where he's just saying, "Is Ray there?" or asking, "Is Ray there?" And one victim posted on the YouTube that's him. You know, and she was like 13, I think, when she was attacked by him. And there's at least those two phone calls out there that I would encourage listeners to go and listen to, you know, to maybe get an idea of this guy's voice. And I think that's his real voice when he's taunting the police and when he's doing the "Is Ray there?" phone call.
I thought "Ray there" was the call that came into victim number one before the recorded one where that's out there. I thought
that's what that is. Okay.
Yeah, I thought that's the call that came in just before she picked up the other call, and then it was the "they're going to kill you" call.
One thing from the cold case episode that I thought was particularly chilling was when they had the town hall meeting, because the town was so gripped in fear, and there was a guy who said, "You know, I can't believe, you know, there was a husband tied down and he couldn't do anything to protect his wife. I just don't believe that." And then later, that guy found himself tied down as one of the victims of the Night Stalker. And he had that happen to him where he...
Was that confirmed? That was supposed to be victim number 21.
I'm not sure. It was in the cold case episode I watched, but I don't know the details of it.
I was at the Del Deo school meeting, and he was basically chewing out the detectives for letting this go on this long. Mm-hmm. And he was not the next victim, as some people say, but I'm told he was that he was victim 21's husband.
Yeah, it was like later down the line.
Strike.
Yeah.
would be the Italian family.
I've now that you mention that, and I think I might have brought up in the previous episode that we did, was with things like town hall meetings, do you think it was quite possible that he was actually there?
Well, that was the theory they brought up, that he might have actually been there. And, he was, because like serial killers like this or egomaniacs, they like to sort of see the emotional havoc they wreak.
Yeah.
And so it's very, like they said, he was probably there. He saw that guy and then he became a target, you know.
Mm. He wasn't a serial killer yet at that time.
Well, not a serial killer, but
anyway. A serial predator.
A serial predator,
I don't really think he would have been there. Frankly, I think he was too careful to go and show himself. I think he could have been recognized as someone who had grown up in one of the neighborhoods. If you look at his, on one of my pages, when I go over his stalking MO or one of my persons of interest, you can see his overall pattern. He knew Carmichael in Citrus Heights. There's no question. That's the only time he really wandered far from a highway community.
Because I remember reading that he was a guy who would travel to these areas, kind of, in a little bit. Like he
wasn't from. Obviously began traveling, yes, to Davis, to Stockton, to Modesto, to South Sacramento, or the little pocket strike, and then to the Concord area. He would follow the highways. But it's clear when you look at the map, and it was believed by the detectives at the time that he was centered in Carmichael or certainly knew that area. And he did go far into the community, far from the highway, following Manzanita and Madison Boulevard. Those are the main roads that service Carmichael and the Citrus Heights, Fair Oaks area. And so he knew that area. At one point in time, he knew that area very well, and he was quite confident to go there.
John, I want to ask you and Michelle as well. Again, you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I raised this question on the previous episode of Eurons that we did with our guest Cameron. Do you think that, I'm asking this, repeating this question for the perspective of both of you, do you think that Eurons was really good at covering his tracks, or the fact was that the police were just rather inept in their investigation in all this, or both?
I say both.
Both?
Yeah.
I can't say he was that clever, because, you know, how can all these jurisdictions, if we go into it, it's Sacramento Police, Sacramento County Sheriff's, then Stanislaus County Sheriff's, Modesto Police, Stockton Police, Concord Police, Contra Costa County Sheriff's, San Jose Police, then it's Walnut Creek Police, it's Santa Barbara Sheriff's, it's Orange County Sheriff's, it's Ventura County Sheriff's. How can they all be incompetent?
Well,
was that good?
Well, a lot of them actually, and I refer back to the Zodiac case, a lot of them actually withheld, or I believe withheld information from each other, because, you know, Orange County's not going to cooperate with those dummies down in Sacramento. I mean, I'm just putting out two names there, because...
Well, I mean, that's kind of what...
That's a possibility.
That's
I'm not saying
feeling,
that is...
That's the-
I'm not,
that's the feeling
I'm not
you
saying
get.
That is the case. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm saying that is a possibility. That's all.
Well,
I just want to reiterate that.
You know, you watch the movie Zodiac, and you kind of see that there's a disconnected communication between, and that the way it's portrayed in that film, which is, you know, a dramatic film, they sort of portray a disconnect in communication between these different departments that all have different information that has to kind of come together. And as we saw, that these... the puzzle pieces of these separate cases were eventually connected. So is that incompetence, or is it just these are different police units that have different bits of information that fit together because these crimes are happening in different areas?
I just find it a little tough to sort of digest that somebody that insane can be that clear-headed in their ways of not being caught. It's just...
Well, Sacramento County Sheriff's really had the best shot because they had over 30 cases, so they had a lot to analyze and even got an independent criminologist to analyze his pattern. And he said, of course, he's based in Carmichael around this area. But then it becomes a crystal ball. It's the night. You have other jurisdictions trying to understand what it's like out there because, you know, they don't have eyes out everywhere. This guy walked in the shadows, and he popped up over people's beds with a flashlight in their eyes. and then got away over the fence and into a car somewhere. What could they do to get someone like this? You know, who is going to report a stalking car in the neighborhood? He was associated with many different cars. The sheriff's memorandum that's been released says he's been, associated with every car in the Blue Book.
And bike.
But are you going to call because there's a suspicious car? It's after the fact that people realize, and that's what the sheriffs had to go out when they canvassed the neighborhood. They got information after the fact.
When I just heard you say bikes, I remember hearing about bikes
stole
as well.
Bike.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They stole bicycles. It was weird. Like, I think in Concord.
He stole a few, yeah.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, he hasn't even leave any murder weapon or very much evidence, did he? He knew what he was doing a little bit. He knew how to cover his tracks. He didn't leave murder weapons, and he, didn't leave. Well, did he leave his ligature? I guess he probably did in a couple places, didn't he? But he took them with him for most of them.
He always wore gloves. He never touched anything without gloves.
Yeah.
And so what's he leaving back then? Not even DNA. No one thought of DNA back then.
Right.
So it would be a test for his blood, and he was a non-secretor, according to the blood tests, which is he didn't secrete the enzymes that identified his blood in saliva. That would be a non-secretor. That's a 15% of community. And so he had he was underendowed. The offending organ was underendowed, to put it politely.
Yeah.
And so how are they going to go match that up with someone unless they catch someone? It would have to be catching him in the act or hot-stopping him or someone afterward and then finding out it's him. But he tied up his victims and gagged them and gave himself time to get out of there. So 30 minutes, 40 minutes later, or an hour when they got loose, he was long gone out of the community. And again, all the canvassing by the sheriffs was just to get information after the fact. You know, neighbors came out and said there was this strange car, this guy was walking around, or they were all getting these strange hang-up phone calls, and it never led anywhere to anyone. They tested, I don't know how many thousands of guys, to see if they were non-secretors, and that's really all they had.
Michelle, I want to ask you, did they ever take, I keep prefacing by saying if you don't answer, you don't have to, because I just know how much of a delicate subject this is with you. 30 years on, did they ever take Janelle's clothes and haul them away? And is there some sort of DNA testing be done on them? Can DNA be traced this far back? For this
guy? They did get DNA.
They did, okay.
Janelle.
Right. But there was no match to it, to anybody.
No, he's never been matched to anybody.
Never been matched, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
No, it only matched Janelle to being a victim of all, of the EAR.
Yeah, now what I find interesting is his variance of using a gun and using a knife or an object to basically bludgeon a victim is, like, in some cases he's got a 357 Magnum, in other cases he doesn't have a gun on him. Do you have any theories, John, why that might be? Or maybe he was caught on a job site where he couldn't bring a pistol, or...
I think he almost always had a gun. Maybe it wasn't seen sometimes, but he had a 357. He had a snub nose, could have been a Colt. He had a automatic 45. He had another type of 38. He would use an ice pick sometimes. There were a couple times when a gun was not seen. That's true. So it could have been inconvenient for him. There was that mistake he made in Davis where he had his T-shirt on backwards and the victim saw the tag when he was rooting through her closet. So I figured he must have put that on in the dark. He must have switched out in his car or whatever he was doing, that he was there.
Right.
I didn't realize he put his T-shirt on backwards. That's when he had the ice pick, I think, or he'd use his scissors, stuff like that. But he was awfully careful, awfully methodical. And as you can see, he was never caught. I don't even think they came close, frankly, because they were using the non-secretor test. And I think they were looking for someone a little too older. I think he was younger. He was outside the dragnet. And I think he, my opinions, based on my own person of interest is that he did grow up in Carmichael, but that he was living further away at that time and coming back to an area he knew in the interim striking along Highway 50.
You're saying you've got somebody in mind who you think it may be, but obviously you're not going to name names.
His initials are on my site. There's a whole page devoted to him.
Okay.
He did grow up in Carmichael, and his family moved away to Placerville, where he grew up. And he would come back, in my research, that he would come back to an area he knew. And the strikes, he did live in two different homes within the very area where EAR concentrated.
Yeah.
And he had all the connections that my research shows EAR would have to have. Connections to auto wrecking to get all those jalopies,
yep.
Construction.
Okay.
And, even if I'm wrong about my main person of interest, I still think he is more or less like an archetype for what EAR would be and why the police didn't really get him, is that he was outside the dragnet. He was driving even in the very beginning to his strike points.
Mm.
Which he did later, all the Contra Costa, the Southern California attacks, the Modesto, Stockton, Davis, obviously he drove to those up to an hour away from where he must have based himself. So I don't think it was expected or suspected at the time that he actually began that way, that he was coming back from maybe 40 minutes away and striking in an area he knew where he did not live anymore.
Did the police ever have anybody as a person of interest? It sounds like they didn't. They had nothing.
Well, they have person of interest and a suspect are two different things.
Yeah, well, yeah.
They had
suspect is what I meant to say. Right, suspect is what I meant to
say. They had no suspect. I've never heard of any prime suspect, of anybody who lasted very long on the rolls as being a suspect, because they
before they linked the DNA, they did have a guy. Actually, they had two guys they thought possibly were the ones that killed Janelle. And they were looking at those guys for a long time. Oh, no. Do you know about that, right, Jim?
I heard there was someone they were quite interested in. I don't know all the details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy Janelle was with that night. Yeah, that poor guy. I know they looked at him for a long time.
Did you know him, Michelle, at all?
Yeah, I didn't know him very well, but he went to our school. He was, he was our age, so it couldn't have been him. But we didn't know that at the time. You know, there was no link between the DNAs. But he was looked at for a long time. I'm sure that ruined him, with his friends and, there's a lot of...
Yeah.
He went through a lot of hard time with that one for a while.
The connotation isn't exactly something that we would like, pinned above your head as being possibly the East Area Rapist. I mean, not something you'd really want, that tag, especially if it's not you, yeah.
I don't know if they would have tagged him with that. I think it was still considered just an individual murder at the time,
right?
Which is still bad enough.
Right, exactly. At the time, they didn't know who
they are. Right. Now, they hadn't linked, when Janelle was killed, it probably took them a while to link it to the Goleta killings, at least, or the original Night Stalker.
Right.
Yeah, it took 16 years.
I think he was looked at for about a year or two after Janelle was killed, so they really were looking at him for a while.
Yeah. Now, John, maybe you've got the answer to this. Why was he called the original Night Stalker? And that's the label, I think, that always gets him confused with Richard Ramirez in the general public.
Oh,
and I think
absolutely.
That's the reason, that's why this case has remained, I think, so obscure, is because the labeling is so confusing. If he'd just been called the California Night Predator, we would have been able to, okay, it's this guy, and it would be better known.
Well, that's just because he struck over so much distance and over so much time as well, and then shifted his MO. I believe it was a Santa Barbara detective who called him Night Stalker because this guy was just too good that they were dealing with. And then I've heard that it was Larry Poole who called him Night Stalker, who was an Orange County detective. But since these were very hard to link, since he struck from Dana Point to Goleta, which is a huge amount of space, huge area, from the south of L.A. to way in the north, they were very tentative about linking him, and it never got on with the police. But Richard Ramirez started striking in the 80s in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles media is so much more powerful. And they called him Night Stalker, and it hooked. But the actual police called EAR Night Stalker before, but it never really got in the media. And they still call him that. When I talk to a detective down there, he will still say Night Stalker.
Really?
But they call Ramirez the Night Stalker. So everybody else calls him Original Night Stalker. So I called him Night Predator to try and keep something original, but that, you know, it says it all. He was a Night Predator. He wasn't just a killer. He did so much more. He wasn't just a rapist. He did all this killing.
What was the Visalia? What did you say it was? John
Visalia Ransacker?
Ransacker, yeah. That was it, yeah. That was not him? Well, they're not sure.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't believe so either. John and I kicked this around on Facebook for a while. We didn't. Neither of us really thought there was much to that connection. You know, other than a few.
Figure out who that was.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's somebody who definitely should have been caught, but we don't think it's the same guy. I mean, the weight, there's like a body weight difference that's really drastic.
If McGowan and the other witnesses in Visalia saw the real Ransacker, then there would be. He was a knock-kneed, kind of white-hipped, chubby guy who was talking to Joe, whoever Joe was. Joe wasn't there.
Yeah.
So he was talking to someone who wasn't there, and he leapt over fences, and he had an unusual knack of finding homes that were empty for that night and getting away. And that's why people thought it could be EAR when he was younger and beginning, because EAR seems to appear as a very skilled prowler. And they can't imagine he wasn't working somewhere else first. He just had not been raping yet. But I don't think they're one and the same. But the Visalia Ransacker is thought to have killed Claude Snelling, so he would still be viable for prosecution.
All right. Is his athleticism exaggerated with the fence leaping and supposedly roof jumping? And another one detective claims his son was screaming one night because he believes the Irons was looking upside down into the kid's bedroom window at night.
You know, I know that house, and I went and looked at it, and I don't see how anybody could, on the pitch of that roof, look into the bedroom window and not fall off.
Right.
I mean, to actually look underneath the gutter in down far enough, you couldn't do that even with one arm holding on and one arm free. I don't know how that's possible.
Right.
At all. He did run over someone's roof someplace. I know about that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's exaggerated. I mean, if, you know, he was skinny enough, he was young enough, someone sees him jump a fence real quick, they think he's agile. But I don't know if he was exceptionally athletic. He just might have been pretty agile.
And he's only like 100. He was thought to be only like 150 pounds, maybe 160 pounds.
Yeah.
Not really heavy. Yeah. So that's a huge advantage. Right. Not a big guy. So that's actually a good size to jump fences and, you know, climb up on a roof and stuff and maybe not be heard. Although I think there's
late teens.
Right. And I do follow the theory he was in his late teens, because I read about the early attacks on your site, which I think is probably about the most detailed resource on the internet on this case. And it just, the early attacks seem like a young guy really trying to figure out how to commit these crimes. You know, it doesn't seem like he's a professional or anything.
Yeah, and he did feel he could present himself as young from some of the stuff he said. He thought he could get away with, you know, to one victim he said, you know, I have to wait till my parents are home or something like that. So he felt he could get away sounding young.
Right.
A 35-year-old voice isn't going to think he can get away saying something like that.
Exactly, and probably wouldn't want to be seen that way. That would make him seem too weak or, I don't know, doesn't present an aggressive image. If you're talking about your parents or whatever.
That's why he's such a dichotomy. You have on one hand where he is this true life villain like Michael Myers, even, you know, sending dog scent, you know, dogs going crazy. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, he seems like he really is just this young guy who's getting lucky. But he was that premeditated. He did think out his entire stalking MO, his getting there and his escape, you know, then lording over the house in the interim. And that's one reason why, as Michelle was saying, the friend, Janelle's friend, was held under suspicion for so many years. Manuela's husband was held under suspicion for so many years, and he was in the hospital. And
right.
They weren't sure if he paid someone to come kill her if he got out. And that's just why this number one serial predator was, we were able to forget him, as society was able to forget him, because it was so hard to connect him.
Right.
Over the whole state to all these separate crimes. And maybe there's more.
Right. Exactly. I mean, these could be offenses in another state, and we just haven't been, it hasn't been connected yet. And would explain this absence or silence or whatever you want to call
it.
Now, there's like four or five sketches that were put out when the FBI did a major press conference back in June. It got picked up on a lot of media. They presented sketches, and you know, it seems to be the opinion of detectives is at least three of those sketches aren't him. Like the one we always call the Bill Mumy sketch is thought to be the real, legit, authentic sketch of him.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Even if you average them out, he had a long face. He might have had a very a narrow jaw or lower jaw. He might have had an issue why he disguised his voice. My person of interest certainly did have an incredible underbite. But so we're looking at, if you want to be conservative, he had a long face. He was about 5'9". He had brown to blonde hair. And I don't think there's that one sketch that looks like Kaczynski. It's called the Kaczynski sketch.
Oh, yeah.
With the Majora double murders. I don't think that's him at all. Even if he was there, that sketch is not of him. He did not have short military type of hair cut.
Right.
He parted his hair on the right, apparently, quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
He might have worn wigs. We just don't know. Yeah. But I would say long face is a safe guess.
Yeah. And I think the detective, it was his name Shelley, the one who also said that claimed he was on his rooftop. I think he... In his book, now I haven't read it, but someone had said that he believes he may have actually encountered him one night while he was driving around. Like, because it matched that, what we call the Bill Mumy sketch with the long face and the sneer.
Well, I've read the book. I don't remember that, where he thinks he encountered him. I know he believes he was on his roof. And he lived in Rancho Cordova, right? Because I know the house. He mentioned the address in his book. You can go find
right.
it on Google Earth as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I recommend people read those books,
mm-hmm.
but who can say anymore? We're talking about Dark 70s Nights from 40 years ago.
There exactly.
Quite a few people might have passed him. He was certainly unsuspected. You look at all these sketches, and I think you can pick out a couple of guys who certainly aren't him, especially when locals who are in the sheriff telling me how Del Campo Park, which was a major hub he used to strike in that area, and around Del Deo, these were known drug pass-off areas, and there were some young guys in the high schools there that were known to be dopers.
Right.
And a couple of the sketches look like a couple of the guys that I know were around at that time. So, you know, some of these suspicious people were there for other reasons, some of these suspicious young guys.
I doubt he's a doper, because you can't be that careful and meticulous and be strung out on something. It's just impossible, in my opinion, anyway.
I think he was too. It was an act when he would act like he had the shivers and that he was going to go on withdrawals. Even the victim said they thought he was acting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
he might have done drugs, but I think it was the point where he was, you know, uncontrollable.
Didn't he cry before a victim? Yeah, I think he supposedly cried before a victim and talked about his mommy doesn't like the reports on TV or something.
I think that was a put on too. He would sob before a number of victims, and it was after the reports came out in the newspaper that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. And I think he was simply putting on his act of what he thought a paranoid schizophrenic would sound like, and it was just a ruse.
And so right. Gaslighting his victims.
Some of the victims thought it was for real. You know, some said they thought it was for real. But he would then, go, you know, after he raped him, he'd go into a corner and sob and, oh, mommy, I don't want to do this. And then he'd come back and be snarling in their ear and clipping scissors by their ears. And,
good God.
So it's like something out of a William Castle movie.
Performing. This was, a captive audience.
For yeah.
Him.
Well, that's the, now there, this is another strange thing about this case of many strange things. It seems that in some cases he's a total coward. In other situations, he's strangely aggressive. Like, supposedly, someone stopped at a stop sign, and he walked over and tapped on her window with a knife, and he had his mask on.
No, sorry. Anybody who rapes and kills women or anybody is a coward in this story.
Yeah, he is, but I'm talking about the behavior, the tactics. He seems to be brazen enough.
I don't know if that's really him. There were people being seen with masks and being reported crawling across a lawn with a mask.
Right.
Looking in someone's window with a mask.
Could just be goofy.
I have people emailing me today saying they saw him looking in his window, in their window.
And, you know, things I read claim that Sacramento was just crawling with weirdos around that time anyway, which made it even more, you know, tougher to find him.
Well, it was a weird time anyway with all the new drug use that was becoming the new fashion of the
right.
70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the anti-establishment movement seemed to usher in so much, you know, the most ingenuitive serial predators as well. They went the extra mile. And he
yeah.
just seems to fit in with that, except that unlike the others, unlike Zodiac or the Ripper or the great ones in the halls of serial crime, I think this guy is still attainable. He would not be 60 years old. And I think it's he's number one in the genre now, obviously, in true crime, but he's only now his case is only now spilling over into the mainstream. And the more people hear about it, I think it's better because someone might just say, you know, either they'll confirm my guy was really the EAR, or they'll come up with the right guy, or someone will finally say, you know, when I cleaned out my cousins or my brother's stuff or my uncle's drawers, all these old license photos, these driver's license, he stole those from the
victims. Oh, no, not that's the old, my daddy's a Zodiac book we get once every 2 weeks.
I hope not, but I hope
yeah.
they call, if they get this box of stuff that they clean out, and it's jewelry or it's souvenirs or it's driver's license photos or all these different photos, and they say, hey, I think, you know, this guy was up to something years ago, then maybe that's the only thing that's going to be hardcore evidence that the law enforcement can get a hold of, short of DNA.
It's got to be frustrating, I got to say, and especially for Michelle, that the fact that this case is not as well known as some others out there. It almost seems like it's been just pushed aside and dismissed with because they haven't found anything. Is that because the police...
Michelle's really helping now. She's becoming... I guess, Michelle, you're becoming a focal point for some of the victims. They're talking to you now.
I'm just trying... I just, for so many years, I didn't do very much, you know, and I'm just trying to get the word out there about the case, get it more known to the public, and hopefully bring, you know, a lead that leads to the killer. You know, and then that's one thing that I'm trying to do. And the other thing is, yeah, bring some of the victims together because, gosh, you know, we've all been victimized in some way, 60 of us, and none of us know each other. We have a lot in common, you know, we could probably help each other.
Do you think it's because they're unwilling to come together because there is still such an undercurrent of fear that this guy is most likely alive because he was so young at the time of the killings?
Yeah, I mean,
not be that old.
Definitely,
yeah,
definitely. I talked to somebody right now who was a rape victim, and I asked her if she wanted to come on the show with you guys, but you know, she's just not ready for that. And
that's fair enough.
She's she's still in fear. She lives in fear. She won't show her picture or put, you know, let anybody know who she is.
Yeah,
and she doesn't even talk about it with her family. They don't like to talk about it. So.
Yeah. You don't talk about it with your family?
No, I don't. We don't talk about it either. It becomes an argument, so we don't say too much.
It's hard.
And this is decades
like
later.
Decades later. It's almost worse now because you know they want to forget about it and put it behind them.
It's because, as I was just getting back to, the fact that they haven't... I feel a lot of this rests on the police, and I'm not anti-police, believe me, I'm far from it. I'm quite pro-police, but I think in this case they've mishandled it so badly that they don't want to put a spotlight on the actual case now because it has been handled so badly in my eyes anyway, and they just, oh, okay, let's just push it aside. And same with Zodiac, that they probably weren't impressed with the fact that the actual Zodiac film came out 10 years ago because it's like, well, this is a case that's now nearly 50 years old, but you haven't caught him, honestly. So, again, I might be completely wrong.
I agree sometimes with that. I agree with that, too.
Yeah.
But they don't want to be the spotlight.
No, they just want to save face. So it's okay. Well,
All right.
Well, I just want to ask as well, I think it's probably been answered, but I'll do it for the sake of the show. Anyway, Michelle and Jan, do you feel that he is still alive in your heart of hearts, that he is still out there?
I do.
You do?
I think he is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think he's probably right around 60 years old is what I just my feeling, my gut feeling, probably around 60. My sister was 18. She would have been 49 now. So, you know, I'm thinking 10 years older than she was. So 59, 60.
Okay.
Around there. Mm-hmm. That's just my gut feeling.
Okay.
I want him to be alive, but I think he's dead. I think he beat the rap.
Yeah, it seems... I just feel someone who is... who was as prominent as he was in his spree back in the time, just can't lay low. He's one of those guys who loves the attention.
Yeah.
Just to lay low and basically not being heard of since, well, as Michelle was saying, pretty much since 2001 when you received that phone call, which you're quite sure was him. 15 years is a long time for someone like that.
I mean, like, Janelle was murdered when I was one and a half years old. I mean,
yeah,
it's been a while.
I don't know. My gut feeling is pretty strong. I feel like he's still alive.
Huh. You know, it's the first time it's very possible.
That. Yeah, that's how I feel. It's just a sense. It's just a feeling. So
my only guess if he's alive, if he's alive and not seeking attention, is maybe he's frightened of technology like computers being old enough to be in that state of mind. Also, looking at the way Dennis Rader was caught, the BTK killer.
Oh, yeah, because he kind of stepped out a little bit.
Right, he was completely ignorant of computers, and they caught him pretty quick. Because he wanted the attention, and maybe that's a possibility if Iranz is still alive. You know, I think
we know how premeditative he was.
Right, right. He's very overcautious, and maybe he doesn't psychologically need the attention. But one thing about the FBI press conference, and it had me thinking maybe they wouldn't even do this if they didn't. If there's something they're holding back on that he is still alive, like maybe they've got a phone call or something, because they offer the reward and everything, and I think maybe they had a statistic like they thought it 80% chance he was still alive or something like that. I don't know what analytics that's based on, but you know, it's almost like they're holding back, like they know something, like he's still out there somehow. But you know, that's just a guess on my part.
Well, I heard they know the ethnicity from the DNA.
Really? So
and he's part Croatian.
Part Croatian.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm. Does that fall in line with the person of interest you have, John?
I don't know all of his ancestors, but his name certainly is not, you know, I think they were talking like a quarter Croatian, so I don't know his grandparents, what they would have been. Now, I'm hearing that through the grapevine, and, you know, I suppose they could do that. They do those ethnic testing, so maybe they did that, but that's what I'm hearing, part Croatian.
Hmm. Very interesting.
I do have someone who comes on my website from Croatia quite a bit.
Well,
I have analytics. I can tell, you know, who's coming on my website, where they're coming from, what are my popular pages. And so, you know, I do get little, what do you call those, they're little prongs. When I look at the map, I can see where they're all coming in from.
Would you be kind enough to show me how to use Google Analytics? I've tried for 3 years, and I can't work it out.
I thought you knew how to use it, because you were like, oh, we got people from Kazakhstan.
No, that was the old map we had on the server. I could read it easily. Uh-huh. Now they moved it over to Google Analytics. I'm like, ugh, I can't read this.
I don't use Google. I use an Irish, a foreign system.
Huh.
By which I can pick up data.
He doesn't use Big Brother.
It'd be amazing who comes through my site, because the government agencies can't hide their ISP, so I know when the Secretary of State's office and everything comes through.
And that's happened before?
Oh, yes, especially when there's the news. When there was the official news release on June 15, all these official bureaus, the FBI information systems, come through the county authorities, county of Riverside, county of this and that, sheriff's departments, correctional facilities.
Oh, that's exciting.
Oh, yeah, you can, someone from the IRS really likes to come through.
Boy.
CNN's going to do a big documentary, I hear.
Oh, good.
And they were coming in, I'm sure, at one point. I don't look at it, you know, all the time, but I know Time, I didn't know Time Magazine had their own server. Their beacon comes in off the roof of NBC News in New York.
Wow. So there could potentially be a huge media blitz about this case. I mean, there should be.
I would think they would try a miniseries.
I mean, you know, I kind of started hearing about it some just around when Patton Oswalt's wife died, because she was working on the book about it.
Yeah, that's actually
one of the... He's going to finish the novel, I'm told.
You call it a novel sarcastically.
No, that's what the news release said. So I don't know. I had no contact. You know, I did my own investigation. I don't join in the culture of all the popular topics. I knew she wrote an LA Magazine article. I didn't know she had her own website, her own blog. I didn't know whose wife she was.
Right.
Sad that she died so young, but I didn't know any of that. I just read one article by her.
I started seeing like, oh, she was working on that, like when she died. So I started kind of seeing a little bit of a bump there.
Well, the story is she had a POI and she was collaborating with the detective who wrote the last book, Hunting the Psychopath, Shelley, I think is his last name. And, Shelby, that's it. And, supposedly she was contacted by a rape victim from 1973 that her attacker's MO really matched a lot of things about original Night Stalker, and the DNA test is still being run, and that's the big story right now going on the forums and such.
Yeah.
And that was delaying the publication of the book, and they were waiting because she wanted to be the writer that found him, so we'll see.
And so that was way too early for him.
Yeah, and it's and that's kind of what I thought too. But who knows? And maybe this was a younger offender. I don't really know much about that incident. Yeah, she was keeping a lot of things under wraps.
It's pretty easy to see how he began with victim number one. How he refined himself after his mistakes.
Right.
You can tell you're dealing with someone who's beginning.
Yeah, and
that was June 18, 1976, so that would be 3 years after 73.
Right, and supposedly this was an attempted rape, so it wasn't successful. But I don't know. We'll see, I suppose, once this DNA test is run through, and maybe nothing, like a lot of leads in this case over the years, because I've spent a lot of time reading the forums and the history of everybody's theories and seeing them get debunked, and it's pretty crazy what they come up with. They're thinking it's X war heroes and POWs and all this other nonsense, and it's
John McCain.
It just doesn't match anything, what I know about the case.
What is amazing is that this guy was never tagged for anything else, because they do run his DNA through CODIS every 6 months, I'm told, and no one is matching. Either he died a long time ago before they were doing all that, or he was simply that careful.
Yeah. So, I got a pretty solid show here. Anything else you guys want to say tonight before we sign off?
I just hope if he is still alive that this episode in some small way helps to get him caught.
Right.
And bring some peace to a lot of people.
Or spread some awareness, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If anything, spread some awareness at least.
Get the word worm in a few more years,
They think they know who it could be. They got to call one of the detectives in Irvine or up in Sacramento. I mean,
yeah.
anybody they know that they can call.
Yeah.
Irvine Police Department.
Yeah, look up some of the cold case episode. Look up the books. Just see if you can, if you read it and see what you know, if it's something that you're related to.
Yeah. Read the FBI press releases on their website. It's pretty detailed.
It's the Sacramento FBI. If people need to know, they have to be specific. It's the Sacramento FBI.
We should we'll try to post a link when we do the posting on our website,
yeah.
So people will have easy access to that.
Have a few books, links to books, and clips in the show notes.
I would say if you know that if you think you had a weird cousin or weird uncle in California in the 70s and 80s, and you're not so sure about him, and you read up on the story and it kind of matches some things there.
That's everybody. I told you, everybody's got the weird uncle.
Especially in the 70s. Come on.
Yeah, I know.
They also have to know what the souvenirs would be that he took pictures and driver's licenses and certain pieces of jewelry that never turned up with any fence.
Mm. Oh, you'd have
so
to figure that'd be destroyed.
A stash like that, a stash of masks, which I doubt he kept, but he would have kept the pictures, I think, the driver's license, the jewelry that... Maybe stacks of coins he took. He might have spent them. He might have kept them somewhere, collector's coins. Stuff like
and
that.
And what about the different vehicles that he drove, too?
Yeah. Working in a wrecking yard or whatever just sounds like a pretty likely profession or something related to that.
Yeah. I feel like I heard that theory before, but I can't remember where.
Don't you think somebody with that sort of mental instability wouldn't be able to hold down a job, though?
Who said he's mentally unstable?
I mean, he seems like a pretty... Like, that's the thing, Stu. He's a pretty calculated guy. Like, people like that, I don't know, seem a little more... They
evil is not the same thing.
Yeah.
He was very evil, but that doesn't mean he was not intelligent and mentally stable.
Yeah, there's plenty of evil people who are able to, you know, appear normal.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Ted Bundy.
Exactly. I was going to say Ted Bundy as well.
Prime example there. It's like no
one. There you go. Yeah.
Okay.
It's very charming.
Just one last question I've got for Michelle is, do you feel he stalked Janelle for quite a period of time, or was just an impulse thing and he knew her for a week or had met her a week previous, or was he infatuated with her maybe? I'm very, very new to this case.
Well, gosh, Janelle, I don't know if you've ever seen any of, you know, Cameron's trailers, but it kind of shows you how Janelle's personality was. And she had a lot of charisma. A lot of guys liked her. And there's something about her. So I feel like, you know, he probably did spot her. I don't think he knew her well. I think he probably spot her and probably watched her a little bit. And maybe he even had a small conversation, you know.
Hmm.
But a couple nights before she was killed, they also heard some noises. It might have been a night before or two nights before. They had heard some noises. So I'm assuming that, you know, he was probably watching her a little bit.
Okay.
He would do that. He would stalk for a few days in advance. I thought that very night, the friend with her heard things outside the window.
Yeah, they did.
And went out and looked.
Did. Yes, they did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he would. He would visit the house before he would, you know, strike.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if the night that Janelle was killed, maybe that could have been another night he was just stalking because she left, you know, at 10:45 with her friend. Maybe he was just going in the house to check things out, but then she came back 15 minutes later.
So she startled him, perhaps.
It could have been, you know, maybe he didn't expect her and maybe she saw him without his mask and maybe that's why he ended up having to kill her, you know, could have threw him off.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's, six years of doing this show, this is about the heaviest subject we've ever done.
Yeah, it's a heavy. It's,
yeah, really. It's why.
Well, heavy, it's a really heavy thing. Yeah.
It's not Jaws 2, so, you know.
No.
Anything anybody else wants to add?
I'd like to ask Gian if he has do you have any books out? If not, do you plan to get one out? Because your knowledge seems to be quite extensive.
No, the section of the Questor files devoted to the EARONS is my contribution. It was to be laid out the way it is, to be a real-life investigator's presentation of a case. I could not do this in a book because I was going to stalk the stalker, and you can't do that in a book. They've already been written, so that I was going to show all the pictures and the video. And it's been 5 years of doing all of that, of finding all these locations again, speaking with people, collating data, analyzing it, starting from the beginning yet again, and I would never try and... I could not even concentrate enough on it to write a book anymore. I blew a gray cell on this case more than once, and I got sick and so forth. So I'm moving on to other cases. I will continue to investigate this and post updates on the website and, you know, more information and the result of investigations and so forth. But it's published now online. It's to be a very much a photo and text, and it's to be an interactive presentation, which you can't do in a book.
Okay.
They can buy my other books, but... They can go to questorfiles.com and go to books by me and see what I've written and what I intend to write.
That's
all. They can check out my blog.
We'll have links in the show notes to all the sites and pages and everything associated with this episode. So, all right.
That'll
Michelle, have you got any parting words that you'd like to say?
Well, On Rest in Peace, Janelle Lisa Cruz, on my Facebook page that I do for my sister, I posted a bunch of links as well. A lot of different, I guess there's like blogs and pro boards and a lot of different information on there that I just posted today. So if anybody wants to go on there, those are on there.
Yeah. And as I said, we will have links to those as well, that page in the show notes for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Now also, you know, we'll probably also link to Cameron's, if he's going to crowdfund again for Bird with a Broken Wing, the movie about Janelle Cruz that he's trying to get off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, which originally brought us to this story 3 years ago for the show.
Yeah.
So, and be sure to mention, remind everybody of that, and we'll have Cameron on the show again.
And go listen to that episode too.
Yeah, definitely.
Put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, we will.
And,
Yeah, this case bothered me. I want him caught. So
yeah, so no, it's definitely been worth doing multiple shows on it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I hope there's more information because people have to understand what they're looking for because there's the clue out there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe I drugged my heels too long in trying to get publicity to this, but it was Michelle that suggested it finally. And she said, why don't we just do an interview on Skype together? And I said, let's just do the real thing. And I started asking show hosts that I had contact with before from my other book releases. So hopefully there'll be a lot more information out there now in the mainstream.
Yep. Yes.
And Michelle's volunteered to do some of these shows.
So is this the first time either of you have done an actual podcast about this topic?
Mm-hmm. This is my first time.
Oh, okay. Well, very
I hope it hasn't
I've
put
done,
you off.
Other interviews, sure. But
yeah. He said, I hope we haven't put you off of doing any further ones.
Okay. Yeah, I've done different kinds of interviews, but never a podcast.
Okay, well, we feel very honored to have you on.
Yeah,
both of you, actually. Yes.
Yes. It's been great.
And, yeah, hopefully you guys will be on Coast to Coast AM or something in a few weeks and hit the biggest audience possible beyond the podcast.
Well, I'm going to approach them, finally. I'll ask. I've asked other show hosts. They've all said, everyone I've asked has said yes.
Okay, great.
So maybe George Noory will say yes, too.
Yes. You've been on that show before, right?
I have, yes.
Okay, yeah. So you got a good shot. So, yeah, best of luck to you on that.
Yep.
Thank you.
All the best. All the very best. All right, I think we better wind it up. And no offense, I need a couple of aspirins after this because I had a headache to begin with. But this has been information overload for me, and I'm not really capable of absorbing all this information at such an early hour.
It's heavy stuff. It's heavy, Doc. You know.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
By making some sort of light of it, we're not disrespecting anybody.
No. I'm just saying
it's our way of dealing with it. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're usually a rather humorous show. So.
We are.
Yeah. So, not to everybody's liking, but we are a humorous show regardless. But
just a few business things. MidnightMovieCowboys.com. That's where you can find all our shows. MidnightMovieCowboys@gmail.com for show suggestions, or visit us on Facebook. You can just look up Midnight Movie Cowboys, like our page, join our group, join in the discussion, go make fun of us, whatever you want to do. And if you like the show, if you like what you hear, go review and rate us on iTunes. That helps us more than you know.
Yeah, it really does. And donations as well to that guy who sent us that rather nice one. Thanks, mate.
Thank you for the donation.
Talk about a nice surprise for sure. But all right. Well, we'd like to thank Michelle for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you too.
And John
Quasar. Well. I remembered the name this time because I'm terrible with names.
Thank you. Thanks. You guys really helped us kind of take the podcast to the next level. Which is something we wanted to do, and finally figured out how to do it. So here we go.
Not one piece of Morning Zoo humor, huh?
No, there were no AC/DC drops.
No, and no weather checks.
We've never used one actually, so I don't know why I said that.
Yeah, people seem to think we do. All right, well, we'll wrap it up for this week. Thank you to everybody involved. That includes you, Hannah. Say good night.
Good night. Adios.
And that includes you too, John.
Yeah, good night, MAGA dog.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.